15. She's standing outside the 7-Eleven near the office, holding a pack of Winstons in one hand and plucking at the cellophane with the other. She hasn't had a cigarette in almost 5 months, a new record, and she doesn't want to start again now. But what she saw on Bill's computer has torn a hole in the middle of a life she has spent the last 5 years mending. Bill Hodges is her touchstone, the way she measures her ability to interact with the world, which is only another way of saying that he is the way she measures her sanity. Trying to imagine her life with him gone is like standing on top of a skyscraper and looking at the sidewalk 60 stories below. Just as she begins to pull the strip on the cellophane, her phone rings. She drops the Winstons into her purse and fishes it out. It's him. Holly doesn't say hello. She told Jerome she didn't think she could talk to him on her own about what she's discovered, but now, standing on this windy city sidewalk and shivering inside her good winter coat, she has no choice. It just spills out. I looked on your computer, and I know that snooping's a lousy thing to do, but I'm not sorry. I had to, because I thought you were lying about it just being an ulcer, and you can fire me if you want. I don't care, just as long as you let them fix what's wrong with you. Silence at the other end. She wants to ask if he's still there, but her mouth feels frozen and her heart is beating so hard she can feel it all over her body. At last he says, Halls, I don't think it can be fixed.
At least let them try.
I love you, he says. She hears the heaviness in his voice, the resignation. You know that, right?
Don't be stupid. Of course I know.
She starts to cry. I'll try the treatment, sure, but I need a couple of days before I check into the hospital, and right now I need you. Can you come and pick me up?
Okay.
Crying harder than ever, because she knows he's telling the truth about needing her. And being needed is a great thing. Maybe the great thing.
Where are you?
He tells her, then says, something else.
What?
I can't fire you, Holly. You're not an employee. You're my partner. Try to remember that.
Bill?
Yeah?
I'm not smoking.
That's good, Holly. Now come on over here. I'll be waiting in the lobby. It's freezing outside.
I'll come as fast as I can while still obeying the speed limit.
She hurries to the corner lot where she parks her car. On the way, she drops the unopened pack of cigarettes into a litter basket. 16. Hodges sketches in his visit to the bucket for Holly on the ride to the Strike Avenue police station, beginning with the news of Ruth Scapelli's suicide and ending with the odd thing Barbara said before they wheeled her away.
I know what you're thinking, Holly says, because I'm thinking it too, that it all leads back to Brady Hartsfield.
The suicide, Prince. Hodges has helped himself to another couple of painkillers while waiting for Holly, and he feels pretty much okay. That's what I'm calling him. Got a ring to it, don't you think?
I guess so. But you told me something once.
She's sitting bolt upright behind the wheel of her Prius, eyes darting everywhere as they drive deeper into Lowtown. She swerves to avoid a shopping cart someone has abandoned in the middle of the street.
You said, coincidence doesn't equal conspiracy. Do you remember saying that?
Yeah, it's one of his faves. He has quite a few.
You said you can investigate a conspiracy forever and come up with nothing if it's actually just a bunch of coincidences all strung together. If you can't find something concrete in the next 2 days, if we can't, you need to give up and start those treatments. Promise me you will.
It might take a little longer to... She cuts him off.
Jerome will be back, and he'll help. It will be like the old days.
Hodges flashes on the title of an old mystery novel, Trent's Last Case, and smiles a little. She catches it from the corner of her eye, takes it for acquiescence, and smiles back, relieved. 4 days, he says.
3, no more. Because every day you don't do something about what's going on inside you, the odds get longer, and they're long already. So don't start your poopy bargaining stuff, Bill. You're too good at it.
Okay, he says. 3 days, if Jerome will help. Holly says,
he will. And let's try to make it 2.
17. The Strike Avenue cop shop looks like a medieval castle in a country where the king has fallen and anarchy rules. The windows are heavily barred. The motor pool is protected by chain-link fencing and concrete barriers. Cameras bristle in every direction, covering all angles of approach. And still, the gray stone building has been gang-tagged, and one of the globes hanging over the main doors has been shattered. Hodges and Holly empty the contents of their pockets and Holly's purse into plastic baskets and go through a metal detector that beeps reproachfully at Hodges' metal watchband. Holly sits on a bench in the main lobby, which is also being scanned by multiple cameras, and opens her iPad. Hodges goes to the desk, states his business, and after a few moments is met by a slim, gray-haired detective who looks a little like Lester Freeman on The Wire, the only cop show Hodges can watch without wanting to throw up. Jack Higgins, the detective says, offering his hand. Like the book writer, only not white. Hodges shakes with him and introduces Holly, who gives a little wave and her usual muttered hello before returning her attention to her iPad. I think I remember you, Hodges says. You used to be at Marlborough Street Station, didn't you, when you were in uniform? A long time ago, when I was young and randy. I remember you, too. You caught the guy who killed those 2 women in McCarran Park. That was a group effort, Detective Higgins. Make it Jack. Cassie Sheen called. We've got your guy in an interview room. His name is Derese Neville. Higgins spells the first name. D-E-R-E-E-C-E. We were going to turn him loose anyway. Several people who saw the incident corroborate his story. He was jiving around with a girl. She took offense and ran into the street. Neville saw the truck coming, ran after her, tried to push her out of the way, mostly succeeded. Plus, practically everyone down here knows this kid. He's a star on the Todd Hunter basketball team, probably going to get an athletic scholarship to a Division I school. Great grades, honor student.
What was Mr. Great Grades doing on the street in the middle of a school day? Ah, they were all out.
Heating system at the high school shit the bed again. 3rd time this winter, and it's only January. The mayor says everything's cool down here in the low. Lots of jobs, lots of prosperity, shiny, happy people. We'll see him when he runs for re-election, riding in that armored SUV of his.
Was the Neville kid hurt?
Scraped palms and nothing else. According to a lady across the street, she was closest to the scene, he pushed the girl and then, I quote, went flying over the top of her like a big-ass bird.
Does he understand he's free to go?
He does, and agreed to stay. Wants to know if the girl's okay. Come on, have your little chat with him, and then we'll send him on his way, unless you see some reason not to.
Hodges smiles. I'm just following up for Miss Robinson. Let me ask him a couple of questions, and we're both out of your hair.
18.
The interview room is small and stifling hot, the overhead heating pipes clanking away. Still, it's probably the nicest one they've got because there's a little sofa and no perp table with a cuff bolt sticking out of it like a steel knuckle. The sofa has been mended with tape in a couple of places, and that makes Hodges think of the man Nancy Alderson says she saw on Hilltop Court, the one with the mended coat. Derese Neville is sitting on the sofa. In his chino pants and white button-up shirt, he looks neat and squared away. His goatee and gold neck chain are the only real dashes of style. His school jacket is folded over one arm of the sofa. He stands when Hodges and Higgins come in and offers a long-fingered hand that looks designed expressly for working with a basketball. The pad of the palm has been painted with orange antiseptic. Hodges shakes with him carefully, mindful of the scrapes, and introduces himself. You're in absolutely no trouble here, Mr. Neville. In fact, Barbara Robinson sent me to say thanks and make sure you were okay. She and her family are longtime friends of mine.
Is she okay?
Broken leg, Hodges says, pulling over a chair. His hand creeps to his side and presses her.
It could have been a lot worse. I'm betting she'll be back on the soccer field next year. Sit down, sit down.
When the Neville boy sits, his knees seem to come almost up to his jawline.
It was my fault, in a way. I shouldn't have been goofing with her, but she was just so pretty and all.
Still, I ain't blind. He pauses, corrects himself. Not blind.
What was she on? Do you know?
Hodges frowns. The idea that Barbara might have been high hasn't crossed his mind, although it should have. She's a teenager, after all, and those years are the age of experimentation. But he has dinner with the Robinsons 3 or 4 times a month, and he's never seen anything in her that registered as drug use. Maybe he's just too close. Or too old. What makes you think she was on something?
Just her being down here, for one thing. Those were Chapel Ridge duds she was wearing. I know, because we play 'em twice every year. Blow 'em out, too. And she was like in a daze, standing there on the curb near Mama Star's, that fortune-telling place, looking like she was going to walk right out into traffic. He shrugs. So I chatted her up, teased her about jaywalking. She got mad and went all Kitty Pryde on my ass. I thought that was cute, so then...
He looks at Higgins, then back at Hodges.
This is the fault part, and I'm being straight with you about it, okay?
Okay, Hodges says.
Well, look, I grabbed her game. Just for a joke, you know? Held it up over my head. I never meant to keep it. So then she kicked me. Good hard kick for a girl. And grabbed it back. She sure didn't look stoned then.
How did she look, Therese? The switch to the boy's first name is automatic.
Oh, man, mad. But also scared. Like she just figured out where she was on a street where girls like her, ones in private school uniforms, don't go, especially by themselves.
MLK Avenue? Come on, I mean, bitch, please. He leans forward, long-fingered hands clasped between his knees, face earnest.
She didn't know I was just playing, you see what I mean? She was like in a panic. Get me?
I do, Hodges says, and although he sounds engaged, at least he hopes so, he's on autopilot for the moment, stuck on what Neville has just said. I grabbed her game. Part of him thinks it can't be connected to Ellerton and Stover. Most of him thinks it must be. It's a perfect fit. That must have made you feel bad.
Neville raises his scratched palms toward the ceiling in a philosophical gesture that says, what can you do? It's this place, man. It's the low. She stopped being on cloud 9 and realized where she was is all. Me, I'm getting out as soon as I can, while I can. Gonna play Div 1, keep my grades up so I can get a good job afterward if I aren't good enough to go pro. Then I'm getting my family out. It's just me and my mom and my 2 brothers. My mom's the only reason I've got as far as I have. She ain't never let none of us play in the dirt.
He replays what he just said and laughs.
She heard me say ain't never, she'd be in my face.
Hodges thinks, kid's too good to be true. Except he is. Hodges is sure of it, and doesn't like to think what might have happened to Jerome's kid's sister if Therese Neville had been in school today.
Higgins says, you were wrong to be teasing that girl, but I have to say you made it right. Will you think about what almost happened if you get an urge to do something like that again?
Yes, sir, I sure will.
Higgins holds a hand up. Rather than slap it, Neville taps it gently with a slightly sarcastic smile. He's a good kid, but this is still Low Town, and Higgins is still Popo. Higgins stands.
Are we good to go, Detective Hodges?
Hodges nods his appreciation at the use of his old title, but he isn't quite finished. Almost. What kind of game was it, Therese?
Old school.
No hesitation.
Like a Game Boy. But my little brother had one of those. Mom got it in a rumble sale, or whatever they call those things. And the one the girl had wasn't the same. It was bright yellow. I know that. Not the kind of color you'd expect a girl to like. Not the ones I know, at least.
Did you happen to see the screen?
Just a glance. It was a bunch of fish swimming around.
Thanks, Therese. How sure are you that she was high on a scale of 1 to 10, 10 being absolutely positive?
Well, say 5. I would have said 10 when I walked up to her, because she acted like she was going to walk right out into the street. There was a big-ass truck coming, a lot bigger than the panel job that come along behind and whumped her. I was thinking not coke or meth or molly, more something mellow, like ecstasy or pot.
But when you started goofing with her, when you took her game? Therese Neville rolls his eyes.
Man, she woke up fast.
Okay, Hodges says. All set. And thank you. Higgins adds his thanks, then he and Hodges start toward the door.
Detective Hodges.
Neville is on his feet again, and Hodges practically has to crane his neck to look at him.
You think if I wrote down my number, you could give it to her?
Hodges thinks it over, then takes his pen from his breast pocket and hands it to the tall boy who probably saved Barbara Robinson's life.
19. Holly drives him back to Lower Marlborough Street. He tells her about his conversation with Therese Neville on the way.
In a movie, they'd fall in love,
Holly says when he finishes. She sounds wistful.
Life is not a movie, Holly. He stops himself from saying Holly Berry at the last second. This is not a day for levity.
I know, she says. That's why I go to them.
I don't suppose you know if Zap-It consoles came in yellow, do you?
As is often the case, Holly has the facts at her fingertips.
They came in 10 different colors, and yes, yellow was one of them.
Are you thinking what I'm thinking? That there's a connection between what happened to Barbara and what happened to those women on Hilltop Court?
I don't know what I'm thinking. I wish we could sit down with Jerome the way we did when Pete Saubers got into trouble. Just sit down and talk it all out.
If Jerome gets here tonight, and if Barbara's really okay, maybe we can do that tomorrow.
Tomorrow's your second day,
she says as she pulls to the curb outside the parking lot they use.
The second of three.
Holly?
No, she says fiercely. Don't even start. You promised.
She shoves the gear shift into park and turns to face him.
You believe Hartsfield has been faking. Isn't that right?
Yeah. Maybe not from the first time he opened his eyes and asked for his dear old mommy, but I think he's come a long way back since then. Maybe all the way. He's faking the semi-catatonic thing to keep from going to trial. Although you'd think Babineau would know. They must have tests, brain scans and things.
Never mind that. If he can think, and if he were to find out that you delayed treatment and died because of him, how do you think he'd feel?
Hodges makes no answer, so Holly answers for him.
He'd be happy, happy, happy. He'd be fracking delighted.
Okay, Hodges says. I hear you. The rest of today and two more, but forget about my situation for a minute. If he can somehow reach out beyond that hospital room, that's scary.
I know. And nobody would believe us. That's scary, too. But nothing scares me as much as the thought of you dying.
He wants to hug her for that, but she's currently wearing one of her many hug-repelling expressions, so he looks at his watch instead.
I have an appointment, and I don't want to keep the lady waiting.
I'm going to the hospital. Even if they won't let me see Barbara, Tanya will be there, and she'd probably like to see a friendly face.
Good idea. But before you go, I'd like you to take a shot at tracking down the Sunrise Solutions bankruptcy trustee.
His name is Todd Schneider. He's part of a law firm six names long. Their offices are in New York. I found him while you were talking to Mr. Neville.
You did that on your iPad?
Yes.
You're a genius, Holly.
No, it's just computer research. You were the smart one to think of it in the first place. I'll call him if you want.
Her face shows how much she dreads the prospect.
You don't have to do that. Just call his office and see if you can make an appointment for me to talk to him. As early tomorrow as possible.
She smiles.
All right.
Then her smile fades. She points to his midsection.
Does it hurt?
Only a little. For now, that's true. The heart attack was worse. That is true, too, but may not be for long. If you get in to see Barbara, say hi for me.
I will. Holly watches him cross to his car, noting the way his left hand goes to his side after he turns up his collar. Seeing that makes her want to cry, or maybe howl with outrage. Life can be very unfair. She's known that ever since high school, when she was the butt of everyone's joke, but it still surprises her. It shouldn't, but it does.
20. Hodges drives back across town, fiddling with the radio, looking for some good hard rock and roll. He finds the Knack on BAM 100 singing My Sharona and cranks the volume. When the song ends, the DJ comes on, talking about a big storm moving east out of the Rockies. Hodges pays no attention. He's thinking about Brady and about the first time he saw one of those Zap-It game consoles. Library Al handed them out. What was Al's last name? He can't remember, if he ever knew it at all, that is. When he arrives at the watering hole with the amusing name, he finds Norma Wilmer seated at a table in back, far from the madding crowd of businessmen at the bar who are bellowing and backslapping as they jockey for drinks. Norma has ditched her nurse's uniform in favor of a dark green pantsuit and low heels. There's already a drink in front of her. I was supposed to buy that, Hodges says, sitting down across from her.
Don't worry, she says. I'm running a tab, which you will pay.
Indeed, I will.
Babineau couldn't get me fired or even transferred if someone saw me talking to you here and reported back to him, but he could make my life difficult. Of course, I could make his a bit difficult, too.
Really?
Really. I think he's been experimenting on your old friend, Brady Hartsfield, feeding him pills that contain God knows what, giving him shots as well, vitamins, he says.
Hodges stares at her in surprise. How long has this been going on?
Years. It's one of the reasons Becky Helmington transferred. She didn't want to be the white cap on Ground Zero if Babineau gave him the wrong vitamin and killed him.
The waitress comes. Hodges orders a Coke with a cherry in it. Norma snorts.
A Coke? Really? Put on your big boy pants, why don't you?
When it comes to booze, I spilled more than you'll ever drink, honey pie, Hodges says. What the hell is Babineau up to? She shrugs.
No idea. But he wouldn't be the first doc to experiment on someone the world doesn't give shit one about. Ever hear of the Tuskegee syphilis experiment? The U.S. government used 400 black men like lab rats. It went on for 40 years, and so far as I know, not a single one of them ran a car into a bunch of defenseless people.
She gives Hodges a crooked smile.
Investigate, Babineau. Get him in trouble. I dare you.
It's Hartsfield I'm interested in, but based on what you're saying, I wouldn't be surprised if Babineau turned out to be collateral damage.
Then hooray for collateral damage.
It comes out collateral damage, and Hodges deduces she's not on her first drink. He is, after all, a trained investigator. When the waitress brings his Coke, Norma drains her glass and holds it up.
I'll have another, and since the gentleman's paying, you might as well make it a double.
The waitress takes her glass and leaves. Norma turns her attention back to Hodges.
You said you have questions. Go ahead and ask while I can still answer. My mouth is a trifle numb and will soon be number.
Who is on Brady Hartsfield's visitors list? Norma frowns at him.
Visitors list? Are you kidding? Who told you had a visitors list?
The late Ruth Scapelli. This was just after she replaced Becky as head nurse. I offered her $50 for any rumors she heard about him, which was the going rate with Becky, and she acted like I just pissed on her shoes. Then she said, you're not even on his visitors list.
Huh.
Then just today, Babineau said,
some bullshit about the DA's office. I heard it, Bill. I was there.
The waitress sets Norma's new drink in front of her, and Hodges knows he'd better finish up fast before Norma starts to bend his ear about everything from being underappreciated at work to her sad and loveless love life. When nurses drink, they have a tendency to go all in. They're like cops that way. You've been working the bucket for as long as I've been coming there.
A lot longer. 12 years.
Years. She raises her glass in a toast and swallows half of her drink.
And now I have been promoted to head nurse, at least temporarily. Twice the responsibility at the same old salary, no doubt.
Seen anybody from the DA's office lately?
Nope. There was a whole briefcase brigade at first, along with pet doctors just itching to declare the son of a bitch competent, but they went away discouraged once they saw him drooling and trying to pick up a spoon. Came back a few times just to double-check. Fewer briefcase boys every time, but nothing lately. So far as they're concerned, he's a total gork. Bada-boop, bada-bang, over and out.
So they don't care. And why would they? Except for the occasional retrospective on slow news days, interest in Brady Hartsfield has died down. There's always fresh roadkill to pick over.
You know they don't.
A lock of hair has fallen in her eyes. She blows it back.
Did anyone try to stop you? All the times you were in to visit him?
No, Hodges thinks, but it's been a year and a half since I dropped by. If there is a visitor's list,
it'd be Babineau's, not the DA's. When it comes to the Mercedes killer, DA is like Honey Badger Bill. He don't give a shit.
Huh?
Never mind.
Could you check and see if there is such a list now that you've been promoted to head nurse? She considers, then says,
It wouldn't be on the computer. That would be too easy to check. But Scapelli kept a couple of file folders in a locked drawer at the duty desk. She was a great one for keeping track of who's naughty and who's nice. If I found something, would it be worth 20 to you?
50 if you could call me tomorrow. Hodges isn't sure she'll even remember this conversation tomorrow. Time is of the essence.
If such a list exists, it's probably just power-tripping bullshit, you know? Babineau likes to keep Hartsfield to his little old self.
But you'll check?
Yeah, why not? I know where she hides the key to her locked drawer. Shit, most of the nurses on the floor know. Hard to get used to the idea old Nurse Ratch is dead.
Hodges nods.
He can move things, you know, without touching them.
Norma's not looking at him. She's making rings on the table with the bottom of her glass. It looks like she's trying to replicate the Olympic logo. Hartsfield?
Who are we talking about? Yeah, he does it to freak out the nurses.
She raises her head.
I'm drunk, so I'll tell you something I never say sober. I wish Babineau would kill him. Just give him a hot shot of something really toxic and boot him out the door. Because he scares me.
She pauses, then adds,
He scares all of us.
21. Holly reaches Todd Schneider's personal assistant just as he's getting ready to shut up shop and leave for the day. The PA says Mr. Schneider should be available between 8:30 and 9 tomorrow. After that, he has meetings all day. Holly hangs up, washes her face in the tiny lavatory, reapplies deodorant, locks the office, and gets rolling toward Kiner Memorial just in time to catch the worst of the evening rush hour. It's 6 o'clock and full dark by the time she arrives. The woman at the information desk checks her computer and tells her that Barbara Robinson is in room 528 of Wing B. Is that intensive care?
Holly asks.
No, ma'am.
Good, Holly says, and sets sail, sensible low heels clacking. The elevator doors open on the 5th floor, and there, waiting to get on, are Barbara's parents. Tanya has her cell phone in her hand and looks at Holly as if at an apparition. Jim Robinson says he'll be damned. Holly shrinks a little.
What? Why are you looking at me that way? What's wrong?
Nothing, Tanya says. It's just that I was going to call you. The elevator doors start to close. Jim sticks out an arm and they bounce back. Holly gets out.
As soon as we got down to the lobby, Tanya resumes and points to a sign on the wall. It shows a cell phone with a red line drawn through it. Me? Why? I thought it was just a broken leg. I mean, I know a broken leg is serious. Of course it is, but...
She's awake and she's fine, Jim says, but he and Tanya exchange a glance which suggests that isn't precisely true.
It's a pretty clean break, actually, but they found a nasty bump on the back of her head and decided to keep her overnight just to be on the safe side. The doc who fixed her leg said he's 99% sure she'll be good to go in the morning.
They did a tox screen, Tanya said. No drugs in her system. I wasn't surprised, but it was still a relief.
Then, what's wrong?
Everything, Tanya says simply. She looks 10 years older than when Holly saw her last.
Hilda Carver's mom drove Barb and Hilda to school. It's her week, and she said Barbara was fine in the car. A little quieter than usual, but otherwise fine. Barbara told Hilda she had to go to the bathroom, and that was the last Hilda saw of her. She said Barb must have left by one of the side doors in the gym. The kids actually call those the skip doors.
What does Barbara say?
She won't tell us anything. Her voice shakes, and Jim puts an arm around her.
But she says she'll tell you. That's why I was going to call you. She says you're the only one who might understand.
22. Holly walks slowly down the corridor to room 528, which is all the way at the end. Her head is down, and she's thinking hard. So she almost bumps into the man wheeling the cart of well-thumbed paperback books and Kindles with Property of Kiner Hosp taped below the screens.
Sorry, Holly tells him. I wasn't looking where I was going.
That's all right,
Library Al says and goes on his way. She doesn't see him pause and look back at her. She is summoning all her courage for the conversation to come. It's apt to be emotional, and emotional scenes have always terrified her. It helps that she loves Barbara. Also, she's curious. She taps on the door, which is ajar, and peeps around it when there's no answer.
Barbara? It's Holly. Can I come in?
Barbara offers a wan smile and puts down the battered copy of Mockingjay she's been reading. Probably got it from the man with the cart, Holly thinks. She's cranked up in the bed, wearing pink pajamas instead of a hospital Johnny. Holly guesses her mother must have packed the PJs, along with the ThinkPad she sees on Barb's night table. The pink top lends Barbara a bit of vivacity, but she still looks dazed. There's no bandage on her head, so the bump mustn't have been all that bad. Holly wonders if they are keeping Barbara overnight for some other reason. She can only think of one, and she'd like to believe it's ridiculous, but she can't quite get there.
Holly, how did you get here so fast? I was coming to see you.
Holly enters and closes the door behind her.
When somebody's in the hospital, you go to see them if it's a friend. And we're friends. I met your parents at the elevator. They said you wanted to talk to me.
Yes.
How can I help, Barbara?
Well, can I ask you something? It's pretty personal.
Okay.
Holly sits down in the chair next to the bed, gingerly, as if the seat might be wired for electricity.
I know you had some bad times. You know, when you were younger, before you worked for Bill.
Yes, Holly says.
The overhead light isn't on, just the lamp on the night table. Its glow encloses them and gives them their own little place to be.
Some very bad ones.
Did you ever try to kill yourself?
Barbara gives a small, nervous laugh.
I told you it was personal.
Twice,
Holly says it without hesitation. She feels surprisingly calm.
The first time, I was just about your age, because kids at school were mean to me and called me mean names. I couldn't cope, but I didn't try very hard. I just took a handful of aspirin and decongestant tablets.
Did you try harder the second time?
It's a tough question, and Holly thinks it over carefully.
Yes and no. It was after I had some trouble with my boss, what they call sexual harassment now. Back then, they didn't call it much of anything. I was in my 20s. I took stronger pills, but still not enough to do the job, and part of me knew that. I was very unstable back then, but I wasn't stupid, and the part that wasn't stupid wanted to live, partly because I knew Martin Scorsese would make some more movies, and I wanted to see them. Martin Scorsese is the best director alive. He makes long movies, like novels. Most movies are only like short stories.
Did your boss, like, attack you?
I don't want to talk about it, and it doesn't matter.
Holly doesn't want to look up either, but reminds herself that this is Barbara and forces herself to, because Barbara has been her friend in spite of all of Holly's ticks and tocks, all of Holly's bells and whistles, and is now in trouble herself.
The reasons never matter, because suicide goes against every human instinct, and that makes it insane.
Except maybe in certain cases, she thinks, certain terminal cases. But Bill isn't terminal. I won't let him be terminal.
I know what you mean,
Barbara says. She turns her head from side to side on her pillow. In the lamplight, tear tracks gleam on her cheeks.
I know. Is that why you were in Lowtown? To kill yourself?
Barbara closes her eyes, but tears squeeze through the lashes.
I don't think so. At least not at first. I went there because the voice told me to. My friend.
She pauses, thinks.
But he wasn't my friend, after all. A friend wouldn't want me to kill myself, would he?
Holly takes Barbara's hand. Touching is ordinarily hard for her, but not tonight.
Maybe it's because she feels they are enclosed in their own secret place. Maybe it's because this is Barbara. Maybe both. What friend is this?
Barbara says,
the one with the fish. The one inside the game.
23. It's Al Brooks who wheels the library cart through the hospital's main lobby, passing Mr. and Mrs. Robinson, who are waiting for Holly. And it's Al who takes another elevator up to the skyway that connects the main hospital to the traumatic brain injury clinic. It's Al who says hello to Nurse Rainier at the duty desk, a long-timer who hellos him back without looking up from her computer screen. It's still Al rolling his cart down the corridor, but when he leaves it in the hall and steps into room 217, Al Brooks disappears and Z-Boy takes his place. Brady is in his chair with his Zap-It in his lap. He doesn't look up from the screen. Z-Boy takes his own Zap-It from the left pocket of his loose gray tunic and turns it on. He taps the fishing hole icon, and on the starter screen, the fish begin to swim. Red ones, yellow ones, gold ones, every now and then a fast-moving pink one. The tune tinkles, and every now and then the console gives off a bright flash that paints his cheeks and turns his eyes into blue blanks. They remain that way for almost 5 minutes, one sitting and one standing, both staring at the swimming fish and listening to the tinkling melody. The blinds over Brady's window rattle restlessly. The coverlet on his bed snaps down, then back up again. Once or twice, Z-Boy nods his understanding. Then Brady's hands loosen and let go of the game console. It slides down his wasted legs, then between them, and clatters to the floor. His mouth falls open. His eyelids drop to half-mast. The rise and fall of his chest, inside his checked shirt, becomes imperceptible. Z-Boy's shoulders straighten. He gives himself a little shake, clicks off his Zap-It, and drops it back into the pocket from which it came. From his right pocket, he takes an iPhone. A person with considerable computer skills has modified it with several state-of-the-art security devices, and the built-in GPS has been turned off. There are no names in the contacts folder, only a few initials. Z-Boy taps FL. The phone rings twice, and FL answers in a fake Russian accent.
This is Agent Zippity-Duda, comrade. I await your commands.
You haven't been paid to make bad jokes.
Silence, then.
All right. No jokes.
We're moving ahead.
We'll move ahead when I get the rest of my money.
You'll have it tonight, and you'll go to work immediately.
Roger Dodger, FL says. Give me something hard next time.
There's not going to be a next time, Z-Boy thinks.
Don't screw this up.
I won't. But I don't work until I see the green.
You'll see it.
Z-Boy breaks the connection, drops the phone into his pocket, and leaves Brady's room. He heads back past the duty desk and Nurse Rainier, who is still absorbed in her computer. He leaves the cart in the snack alcove and crosses the skyway. He walks with a spring in his step, like a much younger man. In an hour or two, Rainier, or one of the other nurses, will find Brady Hartsfield either slumped in his chair or sprawled on the floor on top of his Zap-It. There won't be much concern. He has slipped into total unconsciousness many times before, and always comes out of it. Dr. Babineau says it's part of the rebooting process, that each time Hartsfield returns, he's slightly improved. Our boy is getting well, Babineau says. You might not believe it to look at him, but our boy is really getting well.
You don't know the half of it, thinks the mind now occupying Library Al's body. You don't know the fucking half of it. But you're starting to, Dr. B, aren't you? Better late than never.
24.
That man who yelled at me on the street was wrong, Barbara says. I believed him because the voice told me to believe him, but he was wrong.
Holly wants to know about the voice from the game, but Barbara may not be ready to talk about that yet. So she asks who the man was and what he yelled.
He called me Blackish, like on that TV show. The show is funny, but on the street it's a put-down. It's, I know, the show, and I know how some people use it. But I'm not Blackish. Nobody with a dark skin is, not really. Not even if they live in a nice house on a nice street like Teaberry Lane. We're all black, all the time. Don't you think I know how I get looked at and talked about at school?
Of course you do, says Holly, who has been looked at and talked about plenty in her own time. Her high school nickname was Jibba Jibba.
The teachers talk about gender equality and racial equality. They have a zero-tolerance policy, and they mean it. At least most of them do, I guess. But anyone can walk through the halls when the classes are changing and pick out the black kids and the Chinese transfer students and the Muslim girl, because there's only 2 dozen of us, and we're like a few grains of pepper that somehow got into the salt shaker.
She's picking up steam now, her voice outraged and indignant, but also weary.
I get invited to parties, but there are a lot of parties I don't get invited to, and I've only been asked out on dates 2. One of the boys who asked me was white, and everyone looked at us when we went into the movies, and someone threw popcorn at the back of our heads. I guess at the AMC 12, racial equality stops when the lights go down. And one time when I was playing soccer, here I go, dribbling the ball up the sideline, got a clear shot, and this white dad in a golf shirt tells his daughter, "Guard that jig." I pretended I didn't hear it. The girl kind of smirked. I wanted to knock her over right there where he could see it, but I didn't. I swallowed it. And once, when I was a freshman, I left my English book on the bleachers at lunch, and when I went back to get it, someone had put a note in it that said, "Buckwheat's girlfriend." I swallowed that, too. For days it can be good, weeks even, and then there's something to swallow. It's the same with Mom and Dad, I know it is. Maybe it's different for Jerome at Harvard, but I bet sometimes even he has to swallow it. Holly squeezes her hand, but says nothing. I'm not Blackish, but the voice said I was, just because I didn't grow up in a tenement with an abusive dad and a drug addict mom, because I never ate a collard green or even knew exactly what it was, because I say pork chop instead of poke chop, because they're poor down there in the low, and we're doing just fine on Teaberry Lane. I have my cash card and my nice school, and Jared goes to Harvard, but don't you see, Holly, don't you see that I never...
You never had a choice about those things, Holly says. You were born where you were and what you were, the same as me.
The same as all of us, really. And at 16, you've never been asked to change anything but your clothes.
Yes, and I know I shouldn't be ashamed, but the voice made me ashamed. It made me feel like a useless parasite. And it's still not all gone. It's like it left a trail of slime inside my head, because I never had been in Lowtown before, and it's horrible down there. And compared to them, I really am Blackish, and I'm afraid that voice may never go away, and my life will be spoiled.
You have to strangle it. Holly speaks with dry, detached certainty. Barbara looks at her in surprise. Holly nods. Yes, you have to choke that voice until it's dead. It's the first job. If you don't take care of yourself, you can't get better. And if you can't get better,
You can't make anything else better. Barbara says, I can't just go back to school and pretend Lowtown doesn't exist. If I'm going to live, I have to do something. Young or not, I have to do something. Are you thinking about some kind of volunteer work? I don't know what I'm thinking about. I don't know what there is for a kid like me. But I'm going to find out. If it means going back down there, my parents won't like it. You have to help me with them, Holly. I know it's hard for you, but please, you have to tell them that I need to shut that voice up. Even if I can't choke it to death right away, maybe I can at least quiet it down. All right, Holly says, although she dreads it. I will. An idea occurs to her, and she brightens. You should talk to the boy who pushed you out of the way of the truck. I don't know how to find him. Bill will help you, Holly says. Now, tell me about the game. It broke. The truck ran over it. I saw the pieces, and I'm glad. Every time I close my eyes, I can see those fish, especially the pink number fish, and hear the little song. She hums it, but it rings no bells with Holly. A nurse comes in wheeling a meds cart. She asks Barbara what her pain level is. Holly is ashamed she didn't think to ask herself. And first thing, in some ways, she is a very bad and thoughtless person. I don't know, Barbara says. A 5, maybe? The nurse opens a plastic pill tray and hands Barbara a little paper cup. There are 2 white pills in it. These are custom-tailored 5 pills. You'll sleep like a baby, at least until I come in to check your pupils. Barbara swallows the pills with a sip of water. The nurse tells Holly she should leave soon and let our girl get some rest. Very soon, Holly says, and when the nurse is gone, she leans forward, face intent, eyes bright. The game. How did you get it, Barb? A man gave it to me. I was at the Burt Street Mall with Hilda Carver. When was this? Before Christmas, but not much before. I remember because I still hadn't found anything for Jerome, and I was starting to get worried. I saw a nice sport coat in Banana Republic, but it was way expensive, and besides, he's going to be building houses until May. You don't have much reason to wear a sport coat when you're doing that, do you? I guess not. Anyway, this man came up to us while Hilda and I were having lunch. We're not supposed to talk to strangers, but it's not like we're little kids anymore, and besides, it was in the food court with people all around. Also, he looked nice. The worst ones usually do, Holly thinks. He was wearing a terrific suit that must have cost mucho megabucks and carrying a briefcase. He said his name was Myron Zakum, and he worked for a company called Sunrise Solutions. He gave us his card. He showed us a couple of Zappets. His briefcase was full of them, and said we could each have one free if we'd fill out a questionnaire and send it back. The address was on the questionnaire. It was on the card, too. Do you happen to remember the address? No, and I threw his card away. Besides, it was only a box number. In New York? Barbara thinks it over. No, here in the city. So you took the Zappets? Yes, I didn't tell Mom because she would have given me a big lecture about talking to that guy. I filled out the questionnaire, too, and sent it in. Hilda didn't because her Zappet didn't work. It just gave out a single blue flash and went dead. So she threw it away. I remember her saying that's all you could expect when someone said something was free. Barbara giggles. She sounded just like her mother. But yours did work. Yes. It was old-fashioned, but kind of fun, in a silly way, at first. I wish mine had been broken, and I wouldn't have the voice. Her eyes slip closed, then slowly reopen. She smiles. Whoa, feel like I might be floating away. Don't float away yet. Can you describe the man? A white guy with white hair. He was old. Old, old, or just a little bit old? Barbara's eyes are growing glassy. Older than Dad, not as old as Grandpa. 60-ish? 65-ish?
Yeah, I guess. Bill's age, more or less.
Her eyes suddenly spring wide open.
Oh, guess what? I remember something. I thought it was a little weird, and so did Hilda.
What was that?
He said his name was Myron Zakim, and his card said Myron Zakim, but there were initials on his briefcase that were different.
Can you remember what they were?
No. Sorry.
She's floating away, all right.
Will you think about that first thing when you wake up, Barb? Your mind will be fresh then, and it might be important.
Okay.
I wish Hilda hadn't thrown hers away,
Holly says. She gets no reply, nor expects one. She often talks to herself. Barbara's breathing has grown deep and slow. Holly begins buttoning her coat.
Dinah has one,
Barbara says in a faraway, dreaming voice.
Hers works. She plays Crossy Road on it and plants V's, zombies. Also, she downloaded the whole Divergent trilogy, but she said it came in all jumbled up.
Holly stops buttoning. She knows Dinah Scott, has seen her at the Robinson house many times, playing board games or watching TV, often staying for supper, and drooling over Jerome, as all of Barbara's friends do.
Did the same man give it to her?
Barbara doesn't answer. Biting her lip, not wanting to press her, but needing to, Holly shakes Barbara by the shoulder and asks again.
No,
Barbara says in the same faraway voice.
She got it from the website.
What website was that, Barbara?
Her only answer is a snore. Barbara is gone. 25. Holly knows that the Robinsons will be waiting for her in the lobby, so she hurries into the gift shop, lurks behind a display of teddy bears. Holly is an accomplished lurker and calls Bill. She asks if he knows Barbara's friend, Dinah Scott.
Sure, he says. I know most of her friends. The ones that come to the house, anyway. So do you.
I think you should go to see her.
You mean tonight?
I mean right away. She's got a zappet.
Holly takes a deep breath.
They're dangerous.
She can't quite bring herself to say what she is coming to believe, that they are suicide machines.
26. In room 217, orderlies Norm Richard and Kelly Pelham lift Brady back into bed while Mavis Rainier supervises. Norm picks up the Zappet console from the floor and stares at the swimming fish on the screen.
Why doesn't he just catch pneumonia and die like the rest of the Gorks? Kelly asks.
This one's too ornery to die, Mavis says,
then notices Norm staring down at the swimming fish. His eyes are wide, and his mouth is hung ajar.
Wake up, Splendor in the Grass, she says,
and snatches the gadget away. She pushes the power button and tosses it onto the top drawer of Brady's nightstand.
We've got miles to go before we sleep.
Huh? Norm looks down at his hands, as if expecting to see the Zappet still in them. Kelly asks Nurse Rainier if maybe she wants to take Hartsfield's blood pressure.
O2 looks a little low, he says.
Mavis considers this, then says, fuck him. They leave.
27. In Sugar Heights, the city's poshest neighborhood, an old Chevy Malibu spotted with primer paint creeps up to a closed gate on Lilac Drive. Artfully scrolled into the wrought iron are the initials Barbara Robinson failed to remember. F. B. Z-Boy gets out from behind the wheel, his old parka, a rip in the back and another in the left sleeve thriftily mended with masking tape, flapping around him. He taps the correct code into the keypad, and the gates begin to swing open. He gets back into the car, reaches under the seat, and brings out two items. One is a plastic soda bottle with the neck cut off. The interior has been packed with steel wool. The other is a .32 caliber revolver. Z-Boy slips the muzzle of the .32 into this homemade silencer, another Brady Hartsfield invention, and holds it on his lap. With his free hand, he pilots the Malibu up the smooth, curving driveway. Ahead, the porch-mounted motion lights come on. Behind, the wrought iron gates swing silently shut. Library Al. It didn't take Brady long to realize he was pretty much finished as a physical being. He was born stupid, but didn't stay that way, as the saying goes. Yes, there was physical therapy. Dr. Babineau decreed it, and Brady was hardly in a position to protest, but there was only so much therapy could accomplish. He was eventually able to shamble 30 feet or so along the corridor, some patients called the torture highway, but only with the help of rehab care coordinator Ursula Haber, the bull dyke Nazi who ran the place. "One more step, Mr. Hartsfield," Haber would exhort, and when he managed one more step, the bitch would ask for one more, and one more after that. When Brady was finally allowed to collapse into his wheelchair, trembling and soaked with sweat, he liked to imagine stuffing oil-soaked rags up Haber's snatch and setting them on fire. "Good job," she'd cry. "Good job, Mr. Hartsfield." And if he managed to gargle something that bore a passing resemblance to "thank you," she would look around at whoever happened to be near, smiling proudly. "Look, my pet monkey can talk." He could talk more and better than they knew, and he could shamble 10 yards up the torture highway. On his best days, he could eat custard without spilling too much down his front, but he couldn't dress himself, couldn't tie his shoes, couldn't wipe himself after taking a shit, couldn't even use the remote control, so reminiscent of Thing One and Thing Two back in the good old days, to watch television. He could grasp it, but his motor control wasn't even close to good enough for him to manipulate the small buttons. If he did manage to hit the power button, he usually ended up staring at nothing but a blank screen and the "searching for signal" message. This infuriated him. In the early days of 2012, everything infuriated him, but he was careful not to show it. Angry people were angry for a reason, and gorks weren't supposed to have reasons for anything. Sometimes, lawyers from the district attorney's office dropped by. Babineau protested these visits, telling the lawyers they were setting him back and therefore working against their own long-term interests, but it did no good. Sometimes cops came with the lawyers from the DA's office, and once a cop came on his own. He was a fat cocksucker with a crew cut and a cheerful demeanor. Brady was in his chair, so the fat cocksucker sat on Brady's bed. The fat cocksucker told Brady that his niece had been at the Round Here concert. "Just 13 years old and crazy about that band," he said, chuckling. Still chuckling, he leaned forward over his big stomach and punched Brady in the balls.
"A little something from my niece," the fat cocksucker said. "Did you feel it? Man, I hope so."
Brady did feel it, but not as much as the fat cocksucker probably hoped, because everything had gone kind of vague between his waist and knees. Some circuit in his brain that was supposed to be controlling that area had burned out, he supposed. That would ordinarily be bad news, but it was good news when you had to cope with a right hook to the family jewels. He sat there, his face blank, a little drool on his chin, but he filed away the fat cocksucker's name, Moretti. It went on his list. Brady had a long list. He retained a thin hold over Sadie McDonald by virtue of that first wholly accidental safari into her brain. He retained an even greater hold over the idiot orderly's brain, but visiting there was like taking a vacation in Lowtown. On several occasions, Brady was able to nudge her toward the window, the site of her first seizure. Usually, She only glanced out and then went about her work, which was frustrating. But one day, in June of 2012, she had another of those mini-seizures. Brady found himself looking out through her eyes once more. But this time, he was not content to stay on the passenger side, just watching the scenery. This time he wanted to drive. Sadie reached up and caressed her breasts, squeezed them. Brady felt a low tingle begin between Sadie's legs. He was getting her a little hot. Interesting, but hardly useful. He thought of turning her around and walking her out of the room, going down the corridor, getting a drink of water from the fountain. His very own organic wheelchair. Only, what if someone talked to him? What would he say? Or what if Sadie took over again once she was away from the sun flashes and started screaming that Hartsfield was inside of her? They'd think she was crazy. They might put her on leave. If they did that, Brady would lose his access to her. He burrowed deeper into her mind instead, watching the thought fish go flashing back and forth. They were clearer now, but mostly uninteresting. One, though, the red one, it came into view as soon as he thought about it, because he was making her think of it. Big red fish. A father fish. Brady snatched at it and caught it. It was easy. His body was next to useless, but inside Sadie's mind he was as agile as a ballet dancer. The father fish had molested her regularly between the ages of 6 and 11. Finally, he had gone all the way and fucked her. Sadie told a teacher at school, and her father was arrested. He had killed himself while out on bail. Mostly to amuse himself, Brady began to release his own fish into the aquarium of Sadie McDonald's mind. Tiny, poisonous blowfish that were little more than exaggerations of thoughts she herself harbored in the twilight area that exists between the conscious mind and the subconscious. That she had led him on. That she had actually enjoyed his attentions. That she was responsible for his death. That when you looked at it that way, it hadn't been suicide at all. When you looked at it that way, she had murdered him. Sadie jerked violently, hands flying up to the sides of her head, and turned away from the window. Brady felt that moment of nauseating, tumbling vertigo as he was ejected from her mind. She looked at him, her face pale and dismayed.
"I think I passed out for a second or two," she said, then laughed shakily. "But you won't tell, will you, Brady?"
Of course not. And after that, he found it easier and easier to get into her head. She no longer had to look at the sunlight on the windshields across the way. All she had to do was come into the room. She was losing weight. Her vague prettiness was disappearing. Sometimes her uniform was dirty, and sometimes her stockings were torn. Brady continued to plant his depth charges. You led him on. You enjoyed it. You were responsible. You don't deserve to live. Hell, it was something to do. Sometimes the hospital got freebies, and in September of 2012, it received a dozen Zap-It game consoles, either from the company that made them or from some charity organization. Admin shipped them to the tiny library next to the hospital's non-denominational chapel. There, an orderly unpacked them, looked them over, decided they were stupid and outdated, and stuck them on a back shelf. It was there that Library Al Brooks found them in November and took one for himself. Al enjoyed a few of the games, like the one where you had to get Pitfall Harry safely past the crevices and poisonous snakes, but what he enjoyed most was Fishing Hole. Not the game itself, which was stupid, but the demo screen. He supposed people would laugh, but it was no joke to Al. When he was upset about something, his brother yelling at him about not putting out the garbage for Thursday morning pickup, or a crabby call from his daughter in Oklahoma City, those slowly gliding fish and the little tune always mellowed him out. Sometimes he lost all track of time. It was amazing. On an evening not long before 2012 became 2013, Al had an inspiration. Hartsfield, in 217, was incapable of reading and had shown no interest in books or music on CD. If someone put earphones on his head, he clawed at them until he got them off, as if he found them confining. He would also be incapable of manipulating the small buttons below the Zap-It screen, but he could look at the fishing hole demo. Maybe he'd like it, or some of the other demo screens. If he did, maybe some of the other patients, to his credit Al never thought of them as gorks, would too, and that would be a good thing, because a few of the brain-damaged patients in the bucket were occasionally violent. If the demo screens calmed them down, the docs, nurses, and orderlies, even the janitors, would have an easier time. He might even get a bonus. It probably wouldn't happen, but a man could dream. He entered room 217 one afternoon in early December of 2012, shortly after Hartsfield's only regular visitor had left. This was an ex-detective named Hodges, who had been instrumental in Hartsfield's capture, although he hadn't been the one who had actually smacked his head and damaged his brain. Hodges' visits upset Hartsfield. After he was gone, things fell over in 217. The water turned on and off in the shower, and sometimes the bathroom door flew open or slammed shut. The nurses had seen these things and were sure Hartsfield was causing them, but Dr. Babineau pooh-poohed that idea. He claimed it was exactly the kind of hysterical notion that got a hold on certain women, even though several of the bucket nurses were men. Al knew the stories were true, because he had seen manifestations himself on several occasions, and he did not think of himself as a hysterical person, quite the opposite. On one memorable occasion, he had heard something in Hartsfield's room as he was passing, opened the door, and saw the window blinds doing a kind of maniacal boogaloo. This was shortly after one of Hodges' visits. It had gone on for nearly 30 seconds before the blinds stilled again. Although he tried to be friendly, he tried to be friendly with everyone, Al did not approve of Bill Hodges. The man seemed to be gloating over Hartsfield's condition, reveling in it. Al knew Hartsfield was a bad guy who had murdered innocent people, but what the hell did that matter when the man who had done those things no longer existed? What remained was little more than a husk. So what if he could rattle the blinds or turn the water on and off? Such things hurt no one.
"Hello, Mr. Hartsfield," Al said on that night in December. "I brought you something. Hope you'll take a look."
He turned the Zap-It on and poked the screen to bring up the fishing hole demo. The fish began to swim and the tune began to play. As always, Al was soothed and took a moment to enjoy the sensation. Before he could turn the console so Hartsfield could see, he found himself pushing his library cart in Wing A on the other side of the hospital. The Zap-It was gone. This should have upset him, but it didn't. It seemed perfectly okay. He was a little tired and seemed to be having trouble gathering his scattered thoughts, but otherwise he was fine. Happy. He looked down at his left hand and saw he had drawn a large Z on the back with the pen he always kept in the pocket of his tunic. Z for Z-boy, he thought, and laughed. Brady did not make a decision to leap into Library Al. Seconds after the old geezer looked down at the console in his hand, Brady was in. There was no sense of being an interloper in the library guy's head, either. For now, it was Brady's body, as much as a Hertz sedan would have been his car, for as long as he chose to drive it. The library guy's core consciousness was still there, someplace, but it was just a soothing hum, like the sound of a furnace in the cellar on a cold day. Yet he had access to all of Alvin Brooke's memories and all of his stored knowledge. There was a fair amount of this latter, because before retiring from his full-time job at the age of 58, the man had been an electrician, then known as Sparky Brooks instead of Library Al. If Brady had wanted to rewire a circuit, he could have done so easily, although he understood he might no longer have this ability once he returned to his own body. Thinking of his body alarmed him, and he bent over the man slumped in the chair. The eyes were half closed, showing only the whites. The tongue lolled from one corner of the mouth. Brady put a gnarled hand on Brady's chest and felt a slow rise and fall. So that was all right. But God, he looked horrible. A skin-wrapped skeleton. This was what Hodges had done to him. He left the room and toured the hospital, feeling a species of mad exhilaration. He smiled at everyone. He couldn't help it. With Sadie MacDonald, he had been afraid of fucking up. He still was, but not so much. This was better. He was wearing Library Al like a tight glove. When he passed Anna Corey, the A-Wing head housekeeper, he asked how her husband was bearing up with those radiation treatments. She told him Ellis was doing pretty well, all things considered, and thanked him for asking. In the lobby, he parked his cart outside the men's bathroom, went in, sat on the toilet, and examined the Zap-It. As soon as he saw the swimming fish, he understood what must have happened. The idiots who had created this particular game had also created, certainly by accident, a hypnotic effect. Not everyone would be susceptible, but Brady thought plenty of people would be, and not just those prone to mild seizures like Sadie MacDonald. He knew from reading he'd done in his basement control room that several electronic console and arcade games were capable of initiating seizures or light hypnotic states in perfectly normal people, causing the makers to print a warning in extremely fine print on many of the instruction sheets. Do not play for prolonged periods. Do not sit closer than 3 feet to the screen. Do not play if you have a history of epilepsy. The effect wasn't restricted to video games either. At least one episode of the Pokemon cartoon series had been banned outright when thousands of kids complained of headaches, blurred vision, nausea, and seizures. The culprit was believed to be a sequence in the episode where a series of missiles were set off, causing a strobe effect. Some combination of the swimming fish and the little tune worked the same way. Brady was surprised the company that made the Zap-It consoles hadn't been deluged with complaints. He found out later that there had been complaints, but not many. He came to believe that there were two reasons for that. First, the dumb shit fishing hole game itself did not have the same effect. Second, hardly anybody bought the Zap-It game consoles to begin with. In the jargon of computer commerce, it was a brick. Still pushing his cart, the man, wearing Library Al's body, returned to room 217 and placed the Zap-It on the table by the bed. It merited further study and thought. Then, and not without regret, Brady left Library Al Brooks. There was that moment of vertigo, and then he was looking up instead of down. He was curious to see what would happen next. At first, Library Al just stood there, a piece of furniture that looked like a human being. Brady reached out to him with his invisible left hand and patted his cheek. Then he reached for Al's mind with his own, expecting to find it shut to him as Nurse MacDonald's had been when she came out of her fugue state. But the door was wide open. Al's core consciousness had returned, but there was a bit less now. Brady suspected that some of it had been smothered by his presence. So what? People killed off brain cells when they drank too much, but they had plenty of spares. The same was true of Al, at least for now. Brady saw the Z he had drawn on the back of Al's hand, for no reason, just because he could, and spoke without opening his mouth.
"Hey there, Z-boy. Go on now. Get out. Head over to A-Wing. But you won't talk about this, will you?"
"Talk about what?"
Al asked, looking puzzled. Brady nodded as well as he could nod, and smiled as well as he could smile. He was already wishing to be in Al again. Al's body was old, but at least it worked.
"That's right," he told Z-Boy. "Talk about what?"
2012 became 2013. Brady lost interest in trying to strengthen his telekinetic muscles. There was really no point now that he had Al. Each time he got inside, his grip was stronger, his control better. Running Al was like running one of those drones the military used to keep an eye on the ragheads in Afghanistan and then to bomb the living shit out of their bosses. Lovely, really. Once, he had Z-Boy show the old debt ret one of the Zappets, hoping Hodges would become fascinated by the fishing hole demo. Being inside Hodges would be wonderful. Brady would make it his first priority to pick up a pencil and poke out the old Detret's eyes. But Hodges only glanced at the screen and handed it back to Library Al. Brady tried again a few days later, this time with Denise Woods, the PT associate who came into his room twice a week to exercise his arms and legs. She took the console when Z-Boy handed it to her and looked at the swimming fish quite a bit longer than Hodges had. Something happened, but it wasn't quite enough. Trying to enter her was like pushing against a firm rubber diaphragm. It gave a little, enough for him to glimpse her feeding her young son scrambled eggs in his high chair, but then it pushed him back out. She handed the Zappet back to Z-Boy and said, "You're right, they're pretty fish. Now why don't you go hand out some books, Al, and let Brady and me work on those pesky knees of his." So there it was. He didn't have the same instantaneous access to others that he'd had to Al, and a little thought was all it took for Brady to understand why. Al had been preconditioned to the fishing hole demo, had watched it dozens of times before bringing his Zappet to Brady. That was a crucial difference and a crushing disappointment. Brady had imagined having dozens of drones among whom he could pick and choose, but that wasn't going to happen unless there was a way to re-rig the Zappet and enhance the hypnotic effect. Might there be such a way? As someone who had modified all sorts of gadgets in his time, Thing 1 and Thing 2, for instance, Brady believed there was. The Zappet was Wi-Fi equipped, after all, and Wi-Fi was the hacker's best friend. Suppose, for instance, he were to program in a flashing light, a kind of strobe, like the one that had buzzed the brains of those kids exposed to the missile-firing sequence in the Pokemon episode. The strobe could serve another purpose as well. While taking a community college course called Computing the Future, this was just before he dropped out of school for good, Brady's class had been assigned a long CIA report, published in 1995 and declassified shortly after 9/11. It was called The Operational Potential of Subliminal Perception and explained how computers could be programmed to transmit messages so rapidly that the brain recognized them not as messages per se, but as original thoughts. Suppose he were able to embed such a message inside the strobe flash. "Sleep now, all okay," for instance, or maybe just "relax." Brady thought those things, combined with the demo screen's existing hypnotics, would be pretty effective. Of course, he might be wrong, but he would have given his mostly useless right hand to find out. He doubted if he ever would,
because there were two seemingly insurmountable problems. One was getting people to look at the demo screen long enough for the hypnotic effect to take hold. The other was even more basic. How in God's name was he supposed to modify anything? He had no computer access, and even if he had, what good would it be? He couldn't even tie his fucking shoes. He considered using Z-Boy and rejected the idea almost immediately. Al Brooks lived with his brother and his brother's family, and if Al all of a sudden started demonstrating advanced computer knowledge and capability, there would be questions. Especially when they already had questions about Al, who had grown absent-minded and rather peculiar. Brady supposed they thought he was suffering the onset of senility, which wasn't all that far from the truth. It seemed that Z-Boy was running out of spare brain cells after all. Brady grew depressed. He had reached the all-too-familiar point where his bright ideas collided head-on with gray reality. It had happened with the roll of vacuum cleaner. It had happened with his computer-assisted vehicle backing device. It had happened with his motorized, programmable TV monitor, which was supposed to revolutionize home security. His wonderful inspirations always came to nothing. Still, he had one human drone to hand, and after a particularly infuriating visit from Hodges, Brady decided he might cheer up if he put his drone to work. Accordingly, Z-Boy visited an internet cafe a block or two down from the hospital, and after 5 minutes on a computer, Brady was exhilarated to be sitting in front of a screen again. He discovered where Anthony Moretti, a.k.a. the fat testicle-punching cocksucker, lived. After leaving the internet cafe, Brady walked Z-Boy into an army surplus store and bought a hunting knife. The next day, when he left the house, Moretti found a dead dog stretched out on the welcome mat. Its throat had been cut. Written in dog blood on the windshield of his car was, "Your wife and kids are next." Doing this, being able to do this, cheered Brady up. "Payback is a bitch," he thought, "and I am that bitch." He sometimes fantasized about sending Z-Boy after Hodges and shooting him in the belly. How good it would be to stand over the dead rat, watching him shudder and moan as his life ran through his fingers. It would be great, but Brady would lose his drone, and once in custody, Al might point the police at him. There was something else as well, something even bigger. It wouldn't be enough. He owed Hodges more than a bullet in the belly, followed by 10 or 15 minutes of suffering. Much more. Hodges needed to live, breathing toxic air inside a bag of guilt from which there was no escape, until he could no longer stand it and killed himself. Which had been the original plan back in the good old days. No way, though. Brady thought, no way to do any of it. I've got Z-Boy, who'll be in an assisted living home if he keeps on the way he's going, and I can rattle the blinds with my phantom hand. That's it. That's the whole deal. But then, in the summer of 2013, the dark funk he'd been living in was pierced by a shaft of light. He had a visitor, a real one. Not Hodges or a suit from the district attorney's office checking to see if he had magically improved enough to stand trial for 12 different felony crimes, the list headed by 8 counts of willful murder at City Center. There was a perfunctory knock at the door, and Becky Helmington poked her head in. "Brady, there's a young woman here to see you. Says she used to work with you, and she's brought you something. Do you want to see her?" Brady could think of only one young woman that might be. He considered saying no, but his curiosity had come back along with his malice. Perhaps they were even the same thing. He gave one of his floppy nods and made an effort to brush his hair out of his eyes. His visitor entered timidly, as if there might be hidden mines under the floor. She was wearing a dress. Brady had never seen her in a dress, would have guessed she didn't even own one. But her hair was still cropped close to her skull in a half-assed crew cut, as it had been when they had worked together on the discount electronic cyber patrol, and she was still as flat as a board in front. He remembered some comedian's joke. If no tits count for shit, Cameron Diaz is going to be around for a long time. But she had put on a little powder to cover her pitted skin. Amazing. And even a dash of lipstick. More amazing still. In one hand, she held a wrapped package. "Hey, man," Freddie Linklater said with unaccustomed shyness. "How are you doing?" This opened all sorts of possibilities. Brady did his best to smile. BadConcert.com 1. Cora Babineau wipes the back of her neck with a monogram towel and frowns at the monitor in the basement exercise room. She has done only 4 of her 6 miles on the treadmill. She hates to be interrupted, and the weirdo is back. Cling-clong goes the doorbell, and she listens for her husband's footsteps above her, but there's nothing. On the monitor, the old man in the ratty parka, he looks like one of those bums you see standing at intersections holding up signs that say things like, "Hungry, no job, army veteran, please help," just stands there. "Damn it," she mutters, and pauses the treadmill. She climbs the stairs, opens the door to the back hallway, and shouts, "Felix! It's your weirdo friend, that Al!" No response. He's in his study again, possibly looking at the game thing he seems to have fallen in love with. The first few times she mentioned Felix's strange new obsession to her friends at the country club, it was a joke. It doesn't seem so funny now. He's 63, too old for kids' computer games and too young to have gotten so forgetful. And she's begun to wonder if he might not be suffering early-onset Alzheimer's. It has also crossed her mind that Felix's weirdo friend is some kind of drug pusher. But isn't the guy awfully old for that? And if her husband wants drugs, he can certainly supply himself. According to him, half the doctors at Kina are high at least half the time. Cling-clong goes the doorbell. "Jesus on a pony," she says, and goes to the door herself, growing more irritated with each long stride. She's a tall, gaunt woman whose female shape has been exercised nearly to oblivion. Her golf tan remains even in the depths of winter, only turning a pale shade of yellow that makes her look as if she's suffering chronic liver disease. She opens the door. The January night rushes in, chilling her sweaty face and arms. "I think I would like to know who you are," she says, "and what you and my husband are up to together. Would that be too much to ask?" "Not at all, Mrs. Babineau," he says. "Sometimes I'm Al. Sometimes I'm Z-Boy. Tonight, I'm Brady. And boy, oh boy, it's nice to be out, even on such a cold night." She looks down at his hand. "What's in that jar?" "The end of all your troubles," says the man in the mended parka. And there's a muffled bang. The bottom of the soda bottle blows out in shards, along with scorched threads from the steel wool. They float in the air like milkweed fluff. Cora feels something hit her just below her shrunken left breast and thinks, "This weirdo son of a bitch just punched me." She tries to take a breath, and at first can't. Her chest feels strangely dead. Warmth is pooling above the elastic top of her tracksuit pants. She looks down, still trying to take that all-important breath, and sees a stain spreading on the blue nylon. She raises her eyes to stare at the geezer in the doorway. He's holding out the remains of the bottle as if it's a present, a little gift to make up for showing up unannounced at 8 in the evening. What's left of the steel wool pokes out of the bottom like a charred boutonniere. She finally manages a breath
but it's mostly liquid. She coughs and sprays blood.
The man in the parka steps into her house and sweeps the door shut behind him. He drops the bottle. Then he pushes her.
She staggers back, knocking a decorative vase from the end table by the coat hooks, and goes down. The vase shatters on the hardwood floor like a bomb. She drags in another of those liquid breaths. I'm drowning, she thinks. Drowning, right here in my front hall.
And coughs out another spray of red.
Cora?
Babineau calls from somewhere deep in the house. He sounds as if he's just woken up.
Cora, are you okay?
Brady raises Library Al's foot and carefully brings Library Al's heavy black work shoe down on the straining tendons of Cora Babineau's scrawny throat.
More blood bursts from her mouth.
Her sun-cured cheeks are now stippled with it. He steps down hard. There's a crackling sound as stuff breaks inside her. Her eyes bulge, bulge, and then they glaze over.
You were a tough one, Brady remarks, almost affectionately. A door opens. Slippered feet come running, and then Babineau is there. He's wearing a dressing gown over ridiculous Hugh Hefner-style silk pajamas. His silver hair, usually his pride, is in wild disarray. The stubble on his cheeks has become an incipient beard. In his hand is a green Zap-It console from which the Little Fishing Hole tune tinkles.
By the sea, by the sea, by the beautiful sea.
He stares at his wife lying on the hall floor. No more workouts for her, Brady says in that same affectionate tone.
What did you do?
Babineau screams, as if it isn't obvious. He runs to Cora and tries to fall to his knees beside her, but Brady hooks him under the armpit and hauls him back up. Library Al is by no means Charles Atlas, but he is ever so much stronger than the wasted body in room 217. No time for that, Brady says. The Robinson girl is alive, which necessitates a change of plan. Babineau stares at him, trying to gather his thoughts, but they elude him. His mind, once so sharp, has been blunted, and it's this man's fault.
Look at the fish, Brady says. You look at yours, and I look at mine. We'll both feel better.
No, Babineau says. He wants to look at the fish. He always wants to look at them now, but he's afraid to. Brady wants to pour his mind into Babineau's head like some strange water, and each time that happens, less of his essential self remains afterward.
Yes, Brady says. Tonight you need to be Dr. Z.
I refuse.
You're in no position to refuse. This is coming unraveled. Soon the police will be at your door, or Hodges, and that would be even worse. He won't read you your rights. He'll just hit you with that homemade sap of his because he's a mean motherfucker. And because you were right, he knows.
I won't. I can't.
Babineau looks down at his wife. Oh, God. Her eyes. Her bulging eyes.
The police would never believe. I'm a respected doctor. We've been married for 35 years.
Hodges will. And when Hodges gets the bit in his teeth, he turns into Wyatt fucking Earp. He'll show the Robinson girl your picture. She'll look at it and say, oh, wow, yes, that's the man who gave me the Zap-It at the mall. And if you gave her a Zap-It, you probably gave one to Janice Ellerton. Oops. And there's Scapelli.
Babineau stares, trying to comprehend this disaster.
Then there's the drugs you fed me. Hodges may know about them already, because he's a fast man with a bribe, and most of the nurses in the bucket know. It's an open secret because you never tried to hide it.
Brady gives Library Al's head a sad shake.
Your arrogance.
Vitamins!
It's all Babineau can manage.
Even the cops won't believe that if they subpoena your files and search your computers. Brady glances down at Cora Babineau's sprawled body. And there's your wife, of course. How are you going to explain her?
I wish you'd died before they brought you in, Babineau says. His voice is rising, becoming a whine. Or on the operating table. You're a Frankenstein!
Don't confuse the monster with the creator, Brady says, although he doesn't actually give Babineau much credit in the creation department. Dr. B's experimental drug may have something to do with his new abilities, but it had little or nothing to do with his recovery. He's positive that was his own doing, an act of sheer willpower. Meanwhile, we have a visit to make, and we don't want to be late. To the man-woman. There's a word for that. Babineau used to know it, but now it's gone, like the name that goes with it, or what he ate for dinner. Each time Brady comes into his head, he takes a little more when he leaves. Babineau's memory, his knowledge, his self. That's right. The man-woman. Or, to give her sexual preference its scientific name, Rugus Munchus. No. The whine has become a whisper. I'm going to stay right here. Brady raises the gun, the barrel now visible within the blown-out remains of the makeshift silencer. If you think I really need you, you're making the worst mistake of your life. And the last one. Babineau says nothing. This is a nightmare, and soon he will wake up. Do it, or tomorrow the housekeeper will find you lying dead next to your wife, unfortunate victims of a home invasion. I would rather finish my business as Dr. Z. Your body is 10 years younger than Brooks, and not in bad shape. But I'll do what I have to. Besides, leaving you to face Kermit Hodges would be mean of me. He's a nasty man, Felix. You have no idea. Babineau looks at the elderly fellow in the mended parka and sees Hartsfield looking out of Library Al's watery blue eyes. Babineau's lips are trembling and wet with spittle. His eyes are rimmed with tears. Brady thinks that with his white hair standing up around his head as it is now, the Babster looks like Albert Einstein in that photo where the famous physicist is sticking his tongue out.
How did I get into this?
He moans. The way everybody gets into everything, Brady says gently. One step at a time.
Why did you have to go after the girl? Babineau bursts out.
It was a mistake, Brady says. Easier to admit that than the whole truth. He couldn't wait. He wanted the nigger lawn boy's sister to go before anyone else blotted out her importance. Now stop fucking around. And look at the fishies. You know you want to. And he does. That's the worst part. In spite of everything Babineau now knows, he does. He looks at the fish. He listens to the tune. After a while, he goes into the bedroom to dress and get money out of the safe. He makes one more stop before leaving. The bathroom medicine cabinet is well stocked. On both her side and his. He takes Babineau's BMW, leaving the old Malibu where it is for the time being. He also leaves Library Al, who has gone to sleep on the sofa. 2. Around the time Cora Babineau is opening her front door for the last time, Hodges is sitting down in the living room of the Scott family's home on All Good Place, just one block over from Teaberry Lane where the Robinsons live. He swallowed a couple of painkillers before getting out of the car and isn't feeling bad, all things considered. Dinah Scott is on the sofa, flanked by her parents. She looks quite a bit older than 15 tonight because she's recently back from a rehearsal at Northside High School where the drama club will soon be putting on the Fantastics. She has the role of Louisa, Angie Scott has told Hodges, a real plum. This causes Dinah to roll her eyes. Hodges is across from them and a lazy boy, very much like the one in his own living room. From the deep divot in the seat, he deduces it is Carl Scott's normal evening roost. On the coffee table in front of the sofa is a bright green Zap-It.
Dinah brought it down from her room right away, which allows Hodges to further deduce that it wasn't buried under sports gear in her closet or left under the bed with the dust bunnies. It wasn't sitting forgotten in her locker at school. No, it was where she could lay her hands on it at once, which means she's been using it, old school or not. I'm here at the request of Barbara Robinson, he tells them. She was struck by a truck today.
Oh, my God,
Dinah says, a hand going to her mouth. She's okay, Hodges says. Broken leg is all. They're keeping her overnight for observation, but she'll be home tomorrow and probably back in school next week. You can sign her cast, if kids still do that.
Angie puts an arm around her daughter's shoulders. What does that have to do with Dinah's game?
Well, Barbara had one, and it gave her a shock. Based on what Holly told Hodges while he was driving over here, that's no lie. She was crossing a street at the time, lost her bearings for a minute, and bammo. A boy pushed her clear, or it would have been much worse.
Jesus, Carl says.
Hodges leans forward, looking at Dinah. I don't know how many of these gadgets are defective, but it's clear from what happened to Barb and a couple of other incidents we know of that at least some of them are.
Let this be a lesson to you, Carl says to his daughter. The next time someone tells you a thing's free, be on your guard.
This prompts another eye roll of the perfect teenage variety. The thing I'm curious about, Hodges says, is how you came by yours in the first place. It's kind of a mystery, because the Zap-It company didn't sell many. They were bought out by another company when it flopped, and that company went bankrupt in April 2 years ago. You'd think the Zap-It consoles would have been held for resale to help pay the bills.
Or destroyed, Carl says. That's what they do with unsold paperbacks, you know?
I'm actually aware of that, Hodges says. So tell me, Dinah, how did you get it?
I went on the website, she says. I'm not in trouble, am I? I mean, I didn't know. But Daddy always says ignorance of the law is no excuse.
You're in zero trouble, Hodges assures her. What website was this?
It was called badconcert.com. I looked for it on my phone when Mom called me at rehearsal and said you were coming over, but it's gone. I guess they gave away all the ones they had.
Or found out that things were dangerous and folded their tents without warning anyone,
Angie Scott says, looking grim.
How bad could the shock be, though? Carl asks. I opened up the back when Dee brought it down from her room. There's nothing in there but four rechargeable double A's.
I don't know about that stuff, Hodges says. His stomach is starting to hurt again in spite of the dope. Not that his stomach is actually the problem. It's an adjacent organ only 6 inches long. He took a moment after his meeting with Norma Wilmer to check the survival rate of patients with pancreatic cancer. Only 6% of them managed to live 5 years. Not what you'd call cheery news. So far, I haven't even managed to reprogram my iPhone's text message alert so it doesn't scare innocent bystanders.
I can do that for you, Dinah says. Easy peasy. I have Crazy Frog on mine.
Tell me about the website first.
There was a tweet, okay? Someone at school told me about it. It got picked up on lots of social media sites. Facebook, Pinterest, Google+. You know the ones I'm talking about.
Hodges doesn't, but nods.
I can't remember the tweet exactly, but pretty close. Because they can only be 140 characters long. You know that, right?
Sure, Hodges says. Although he barely grasps what a tweet is. His left hand is trying to sneak its way to the pain in his side. He makes it stay put.
This one said something like...
Dinah closes her eyes. It's rather theatrical, but of course she just did come from a drama club rehearsal.
Bad news. Some nut got the round here concert canceled. Want some good news? Maybe even a free gift? Go to badconcert.com.
She opens her eyes.
That's probably not exact, but you get the idea.
I do, yeah. He jots the website name in his notebook. So, you went there?
Sure. Lots of kids went there. It was kind of funny, too. There was a Vine of Round Here singing their big song from a few years ago, Kisses on the Midway, it was called. And after about 20 seconds, there's an explosion sound and this quacky voice saying, Oh, damn, show canceled.
I don't think that's so funny, Angie says. You all could have been killed.
There must have been more to it than that, Hodges says.
Sure. It said that there were like 2,000 kids there,
a lot of them at their first concert, and they got screwed out of the experience of a lifetime. Although, screwed wasn't the word they used.
I think we can fill in that blank, dear one, Carl says.
And then it said that Round Here's corporate sponsor had received a whole bunch of Zappit game consoles, and they wanted to give them away to, you know, kind of make up for the concert.
Even though that was almost 6 years ago? Angie looks incredulous.
Yeah, kind of weird when you think of it.
But you didn't, Carl said. Think of it.
Dinah shrugs, looking petulant.
I did, but it seemed okay.
Famous last words, her father says.
So you just... What? Hodges asks. Emailed in your name and address and got that... He points to the Zappit. In the mail?
There was a little more to it than that, Dinah says. You had to, like, be able to prove you were actually there. So I went to see Barb's mom, you know, Tanya.
Why?
For the pictures. I think I have mine somewhere, but I couldn't find them.
Her room, Angie says, and this time she's the one with the eye roll.
Hodge's side has picked up a slow, steady throb. What pictures, Dinah?
Okay, it was Tanya. She doesn't mind if we call her that, who took us to the concert, see? There was Barb, me, Hilda Carver, and Betsy.
Betsy would be...
Betsy DeWitt, Angie says. The deal was the moms drew straws to see who would take the girls. Tanya lost. She took Jenny Carver's van because it was the biggest.
Hodges nods his understanding.
So anyway, when we got there, Dinah says, Tanya took pictures of us. We had to have pictures. Sounds stupid, I guess, but we were just little kids. I'm into Mendoza Line and Ravenettes now, but back then Round Here was a really big deal to us, especially Cam, the lead singer. Tanya used our phones, or maybe she used her own, I can't exactly remember, but she made sure we all had copies, only I couldn't find mine.
You had to send a picture to the website as proof of attendance.
Right, by email. I was afraid the pics would only show us standing in front of Mrs. Carver's van, and that wouldn't be enough, but there were two that showed the Mingo Auditorium in the background with all the people lined up. I thought even that might not be good enough because it didn't show the sign with the band's name on it, but it was, and I got the Zappit in the mail just a week later. It came in a big padded envelope.
Was there a return address?
Uh-huh. I can't remember the box number, but the name was Sunrise Solutions. I guess they were the tour sponsors.
It's possible that they were, Hodges thinks. The company wouldn't have been bankrupt back then, but he doubts it. Was it mailed from here in the city?
I don't remember.
I'm pretty sure it was, Angie says. I picked the envelope up off the floor and tossed it in the trash. I'm the French maid around here, you know.
She shoots her daughter a look.
Sorry,
Dinah says. In his notebook, Hodges writes, Sunrise Solutions, based NYC, but package mailed from here. When did all this go down, Dinah?
I heard about the tweet and went to the website last year. I can't remember exactly, but I know it was before the Thanksgiving break. And like I said, it came lickety-split. I was really surprised.
So you've had it for 2 months, give or take?
Yes.
And no shocks?
No, nothing like that.
Have you ever had any experiences where you were playing with it? Let's say with the fishing hole game and you kind of lost track of your surroundings? Mr. and Mrs. Scott look alarmed at this, but Dinah gives him an indulgent smile.
You mean like being hypnotized? Eeny, meeny, chili, beeny?
I don't know what I mean exactly, but okay, say that.
Nope, Dinah says cheerily. Besides, fishing hole is really dumb. It's for little kids. You use the joystick thingy beside the keypad to operate Fisherman Joe's net, see? And you get points for the fish you catch. But it's too easy. Only reason I check back on that one is to see if the pink fish are showing numbers yet.
Numbers?
Yes. The letter that came with the game explained about them. I tacked it on my bulletin board because I'd really like to win that moped. Want to see it?
I sure would. When she bounces upstairs to get it, Hodges asks if he can use the bathroom. Once in there, he unbuttons his shirt and looks at his throbbing left side. It seems a little swollen and feels a little hot to the touch, but he supposes both of those things could be his imagination. He flushes the toilet and takes two more of the white pills. Okay,
he asks, his throbbing side. Can you just shut up a while and let me finish here? Dinah has scrubbed off most of her stage makeup, and now it's easy for Hodges to imagine her and the other three girls at 9 or 10 going to their first concert and as excited as Mexican jumping beans in a microwave. She hands him the letter that came with the game. At the top of the sheet is a rising sun with the words Sunrise Solutions bent over it in an arc. Pretty much what you'd expect, only it doesn't look like any corporate logo Hodges has ever seen. It's strangely amateurish, as if the original was drawn by hand. It's a form letter with the girl's name plugged in to give it a more personal feel. Not that anybody's apt to be fooled by that in this day and age, Hodges thinks, when even mass mailings from insurance companies and ambulance-chasing lawyers come personalized.
Dear Dinah Scott, congratulations. We hope you will enjoy your Zap-It game console, which comes preloaded with 65 fun and challenging games. It is also Wi-Fi equipped, so you can visit your favorite internet sites and download books as a member of the Sunrise Readers Circle. You are receiving this free gift to make up for the concert you missed. But of course, we hope you will tell all your friends about your wonderful Zap-It experience. And there's more. Keep checking the Fishing Hole demo screen and keep tapping those pink fish, because someday, you won't know when until it happens, you will tap them and they will turn into numbers. If the fish you tap add up to one of the numbers below, you will win a great prize, but the numbers will only be visible for a short time. So keep checking. Add to the fun by staying in touch with others in the Zap-It Club by going to ztheend.com, where you can also claim your prize if you are one of the lucky ones. Thanks from all of us at Sunrise Solutions and the whole Zap-It team.
There was an unreadable signature, hardly more than a scribble. Below that,
lucky numbers for Dinah Scott. 1034 equals $25 gift certificate at Deb. 1781 equals $40 gift card at Atom Arcade. 1946 equals $50 gift certificate at Carmike Cinemas. 7459 equals Wave 50cc Moped Scooter, grand prize. You actually believed this bullshit? Carl Scott asks. Although the question is delivered with a smile, Dinah tears up. All right, I'm stupid, so shoot me. Carl hugs her, kisses her temple. Know what? I would have swallowed it at your age, too.
Have you been checking the pink fish, Dinah? Hodges asks.
Yes, once or twice a day. That's actually harder than the game because the pink ones are fast. You have to concentrate.
Of course you do, Hodges thinks. He likes this less and less. But no numbers, huh?
Not so far.
Can I take that? He asks, pointing to the Zap-It. He thinks about telling her he'll give it back later, but doesn't. He doubts if he will. And the letter?
On one condition,
she says. Hodges, pain now subsiding, is able to smile. Name it, kiddo.
Keep checking the pink fish, and if one of my numbers comes up, I get the prize.
It's a deal, Hodges says, thinking someone wants to give you a prize, Dinah, but I doubt very much if it's a moped or a cinema gift certificate. He takes the Zap-It and the letter and stands up. I want to thank you all very much for your time. Welcome, Carl says. And when you figure out just what the hell this is all about, will you tell us? You got it, Hodges says. One more question, Dinah, and if I sound stupid, remember that I'm pushing 70.
She smiles. At school, Mr. Morton says the only stupid question
is the one you don't ask, yeah. I've always felt that way myself, so here it comes. Everybody at Northside High knows about this, right? The free consoles, the number fish, and the prizes?
Not just our school. All the other ones, too. Twitter, Facebook, Pinterest, Yik Yak. That's how they work.
And if you were at the concert and you could prove it, you were eligible to get one of these?
Uh-huh.
What about Betsy DeWitt? Did she get one?
Dinah frowns.
No, and that's kind of funny.
because she still had her pictures from that night, and she sent one to the website. But she didn't do it as soon as I did. She's an awful procrastinator, so maybe they were all out. If you snooze, you lose type of thing.
Hodges thanks the Scots again for their time, wishes Dinah good luck with the play, and goes back down the walk to his car. When he slides behind the wheel, it's cold enough inside to see his breath. The pain surfaces again, 4 hard pulses. He waits them out, teeth clamped, trying to tell himself these new sharper pains are psychosomatic, because he now knows what's wrong with him, but the idea won't quite wash. 2 more days suddenly seems like a long time to wait for treatment, but he will wait. Has to, because an awful idea is rising in his mind. Pete Huntley wouldn't believe it, and Izzy James would probably think he needed a quick ambulance ride to the nearest funny farm. Hodges doesn't quite believe it himself, but the pieces are coming together. And although the picture that's being revealed is a crazy one, it also has a certain nasty logic. He starts his Prius and points it toward home, where he will call Holly and ask her to try and find out if Sunrise Solutions ever sponsored a Round Here tour. After that, he will watch TV. When he can no longer pretend that what's on interests him, he'll go to bed and lie awake and wait for morning. Only he's curious about the green Zap-It. Too curious, it turns out, to wait. Halfway between All Good Place and Harper Road, he pulls into a strip mall, parks in front of a dry cleaning shop that's closed for the night, and powers the gadget up. It flashes bright white, and then a red Z appears, growing closer and bigger until the slant of the Z colors the whole screen red. A moment later, it flashes white again, and a message appears.
Welcome to Zap-It. We love to play. Hit any key to begin, or just swipe the screen.
Hodges swipes, and game icons appear in neat rows. Some are console versions of ones he watched Allie play at the mall when she was a little girl. Space Invaders, Donkey Kong, Pac-Man, and that little yellow devil's main squeeze, Ms. Pac-Man. There are also the various solitaire games Janice Ellerton had been hooked on, and plenty of other stuff Hodges has never heard of. He swipes again, and there it is, between Spell Tower and Barbie's Fashion Walk. Fishing Hole. He takes a deep breath and taps the icon.
Thinking about Fishing Hole, the screen advises.
A little worry circle goes around for 10 seconds or so. It seems longer. And then the demo screen appears. Fish swim back and forth, or do loop-the-loops, or shoot up and down on diagonals. Bubbles rise from their mouths and flipping tails. The water is greenish at the top, shading to blue farther down. A little tune plays, not one Hodges recognizes. He watches and waits to feel something. Sleepy seems the most likely. The fish are red, green, blue, gold, yellow. They're probably supposed to be tropical fish, but they have none of the hyper-reality Hodges has seen in Xbox and PlayStation commercials on TV. These fish are basically cartoons, and primitive ones at that. No wonder the Zap-It flopped, he thinks. But yeah, okay. There's something mildly hypnotic about the way the fish move, sometimes alone, sometimes in pairs, every now and then in a rainbow school of 6. And jackpot, here comes a pink one. He taps at it, but it's moving just a mite too fast, and he misses. Hodges mutters, shit, under his breath. He looks up at the darkened dry cleaning store's window for a moment because he really is feeling a trifle dozy. He lightly smacks first his left cheek and then his right with the hand not holding the game and looks back down. There are more fish now, weaving back and forth in complicated patterns. Here comes another pink one, and this time he succeeds in tapping it before it whisks off the left side of the screen. It blinks, almost as if to say, okay, Bill, you got me that time. But no number appears. He waits, watches, and when another pink one appears, he taps again. Still no number. Just a pink fish that has no counterpart in the real world. The tune seems louder now,
and at the same time slower. Hodges thinks it really is having some kind of effect. It's mild and probably completely accidental, but it's there, all right. He pushes the power button. The screen flashes, "Thanks for playing, see you soon," and goes dark. He looks at the dashboard clock and is astonished to see he has been sitting here looking at the Zap-It for over 10 minutes. It felt more like 2 or 3, 5 at the very most. Dinah didn't talk about losing time while looking at the fish and hole demo screen, but he hadn't asked about that, had he? On the other hand, he's on 2 fairly heavy-duty painkillers, and that probably played a part in what just happened. If anything actually did, that is. No numbers, though. The pink fish had just been pink fish. Hodges slips the Zap-It into his coat pocket along with his phone and drives home.
3. Freddie Linklater, once a computer repair colleague of Brady's before the world discovered Brady Hartsfield was a monster, sits at her kitchen table, spinning a silver flask with one finger as she waits for the man with the fancy briefcase. Dr. Z is what he calls himself, but Freddie is no fool. She knows the name that goes with the briefcase initials, Felix Babineau, head of neurology at Kiner Memorial. Does he know that she knows? She's guessing he does and doesn't care. But it's weird. Very. He's in his 60s, an authentic golden oldie, but he reminds her of somebody much younger, someone who is, in fact, this Dr. Babineau's most famous, infamous, really, patient. Around and around goes the flask. Etched on the side is GH and FL forever. Well, forever lasted just about 2 years, and Gloria Hollis has been gone for quite a while now. Babineau, or Dr. Z as he styles himself like the villain in a comic book, was part of the reason why. He's creepy, Gloria said. The older guy is too, and the money's creepy. It's too much. I don't know what they got you into, Fred, but sooner or later it's going to blow up in your face, and I don't want to be part of the collateral damage. Of course, Gloria had also met someone else, someone quite a bit better looking than Freddie, with her angular body and lantern jaw and pitted cheeks, but she didn't want to talk about that part of it. Oh, no. Around and around goes the flask. It all seemed so simple at first, and how could she refuse the money? She never saved much when she worked on the discount electronic cyber patrol, and the work she'd been able to find as an independent IT when the store closed had barely been enough to keep her off the street. It might have been different if she'd had what Anthony Frobisher, her old boss, liked to call people skills, but those had never been her forte. When the old geezer who called himself Z-Boy made his offer, and dear God, that was really a comic book handle, it had been like a gift from God. She had been living in a shitty apartment on the south side, in the part of town commonly referred to as Hillbilly Heaven, and a month behind on the rent in spite of the cash the guy had already given her. What was she supposed to do? Refuse $5,000? Get real. Around and around goes the flask. The guy is late. Maybe he's not coming at all, and that might be for the best. She remembers the geezer casting his eyes around the 2-room apartment. Most of her possessions in paper bags with handles, all too easy to see those bags gathered around her as she tried to sleep beneath a crosstown expressway underpass.
"You'll need a bigger place," he said.
"Yeah, and the farmers in California need rain." She remembers peering into the envelope he handed her, remembers riffling the 50s and what a comfy sound they made. "This is nice, but by the time I get square with all the people I owe, there won't be much left." She could stiff most of those people, but the geezer didn't need to know that.
"There'll be more, and my boss will take care of getting you an apartment where you may be asked to accept certain shipments."
That started alarm bells ringing. "If you're thinking about drugs, let's just forget the whole thing." She held out the cash-stuffed envelope to him, much as it hurt to do that. He pushed it back with a little grimace of contempt.
"No drugs. You'll not be asked to sign for anything even slightly illegal."
So here she is, in a condo close to the lakeshore.
Not that there's much of a lake view from only 6 stories up, and not that the place is a palace. Far from it, especially in the winter. You can only catch a wink of the water between the newer, nicer high-rises, but the wind finds its way through just fine, thanks, and in January that wind is cold. She has the joke thermostat cranked to 80 and is still wearing 3 shirts and long johns under her carpenter jeans. Hillbilly heaven is in the rearview mirror, though, that's something. But the question remains, is it enough? Around and around goes the silver flask, GH and FL forever. Only nothing is forever. The lobby buzzer goes, making her jump. She picks up the flask, her one souvenir of the glorious Gloria days, and heads to the intercom. She quashes an urge to do her Russian spy accent again. Whether he calls himself Dr. Babineau or Dr. Z, the guy is a little scary. Not hillbilly heaven crystal meth dope dealer scary, but in a different way. Better to play this straight, get it over with, and hope to Christ she doesn't find herself in too much trouble if the deal blows up in her face. Is this the famous Dr. Z? Of course it is. You're late. Am I keeping you from something important, Freddy? No, nothing important. Nothing she does is particularly important these days. You brought the money? Of course. Sounding impatient. The old geezer with whom she had commenced this nutty business had the same impatient way of speaking. He and Dr. Z looked nothing alike, but they sounded alike, enough to make her wonder if they weren't brothers. Only they also sounded like that someone else, the old colleague she used to work with, the one who turned out to be Mr. Mercedes. Freddy doesn't want to think about that any more than she wants to think about the various hacks she's done on Dr. Z's behalf. She hits the buzzer beside the intercom. She goes to her door to wait for him, taking a nip of scotch to fortify herself. She tucks the flask into the breast pocket of her middle shirt, then reaches into the pocket of the one beneath where she keeps her breath mints. She doesn't believe Dr. Z would give shit one if he smelled booze on her breath, but she always used to pop a mint after a nip when she was working at Discount Electronics, and old habits are strong habits. She takes her Marlboros from the pocket of her top shirt and lights one. It will further mask the smell of the booze and calm her a little more, and if he doesn't like her secondhand smoke, tough titty. This guy has set you up in a pretty nice apartment and paid you almost $30,000 over the last 18 months or so, Gloria had said. Tall tickets for something any hacker worth her salt could do in her sleep, at least according to you. So why you, and why so much? More stuff Freddy doesn't want to think about. It all started with the picture of Brady and his mom. She found it in the junk room at Discount Electronics shortly after the staff had been told the Birch Hill Mall store was closing. Their boss, Anthony Tones Frobisher, must have taken it out of Brady's work cubby and tossed it back there after the world found out that Brady was the infamous Mercedes killer. Freddy had no great love for Brady, although they did have a few meaningful conversations about gender identity back in the day. Wrapping the picture and taking it to the hospital was pure impulse, and the few times she'd visited him afterwards had been pure curiosity, plus a little pride at the way Brady had reacted to her. He smiled.
"He responds to you," the new head nurse, Scapelli, said after one of Freddy's visits. "That's very unusual."
By the time Scapelli replaced Becky Helmington, Freddy knew that the mysterious Dr. Z, who took over supplying her with cash, was in reality Dr. Felix Babineau. She didn't think about that either. Or about the cartons that eventually began arriving from Terre Haute via UPS. Or the hacks. She became an expert in not thinking, because once you started doing that, certain connections became obvious. And all because of that damn picture. Freddy wishes now she'd resisted the impulse, but her mother had a saying, "Too late always comes too early." She hears his footsteps coming down the hall. She opens the door before he can ring the bell, and the question is out of her mouth before she knows she is going to ask it. "Tell me the truth, Dr. Z. Are you Brady?"